Welcome to the UTG podcast, and today we're joined again by Stephen Grant. Welcome, Stephen.
Yeah, good to be with you again, Alistair.
And in this third episode in our series, where we're thinking about the report done by the Bible Society on the Quiet Revival, in the last episode, we were kind of thinking through the kind of whole generational shift, the change that's in society, this kind of cultural moment where people are inquiring into what the Bible, what Christianity has to say. I suppose one of the things that came out of the report, more so maybe as an implication, is what role does the Bible have to play in public life? And I think that that is an area that people get very nervous about. When you're
in our country,
because I think that, well, you saw that in the leader of the Lib Dems, I can't remember what his name was, but he was a Christian, and in the general election that he got massively mauled for his Christian belief. So there is an intolerance. There's an intolerance in our political system. It's the idea that even when Jacob Rees-Mogg, who was obviously a practicing Catholic, when he was asked about his views on the likes of homosexuality, that's a big issue. It's the idea that, well, all of a sudden, if you get into power, that you're going to be like Oliver Cromwell, and you're going to subjugate the citizens of the United Kingdom and make them all kind of Puritans or some kind of thing. And that's the fear. But so therefore, because of that, it's like, well, the Bible's got no role to play in public life. But I suppose the question is, does it? Should it? And what do we as Christians, what's our expectation? I suppose I think it's helpful just to think fundamentally about what the Bible has to say about what our expectation should be. So again, we're looking here at biblical prophecy. So you have the kind of the three main views of biblical prophecy: amillennialism, postmillennialism, premillennialism. Amillennialism saying there will never be a 1,000-year reign literally of the Lord Jesus on the earth, but rather that it's that 1,000 literal year reign is symbolic, and it's what's happening now through the church. You have the premillennialist view, which is obviously what we would believe, that at a coming point in time, the world isn't going to get better, it's going to get worse, and then the Lord Jesus is going to come back, and then he's going to set up his kingdom. But the postmillennial, popular, I think, before the wars, the two world wars, was the fact that society was just going to become gradually more Christian. And then all of a sudden, the Lord Jesus would come back and usher in his 1,000-year reign. And this kind of whole idea that we should expect an increasing Christianization of our society. But what do you think?
I don't expect that.
No.
And I think that would not be the recent trend in our society either. If you take the bigger view, we look back in the Victorian age as being an age where Christianity was kind of defined our nation. So that the empire spread, and you had the gunships, and then you had the missionaries on the gunships type of thing. So as you look back into that, you can see that as the empire spread, as the British Empire spread, missionaries were part and parcel of that. And so there was the kind of spread of the gospel into areas of the world. And this was seen as, Britain taking the gospel, Christianity.
So this is a genuine question I have. Do you think it was the gospel, or do you think it was cultural Christianity?
I think it was both.
Okay.
So that there was obviously a reality, and there must have been, and there certainly was a reality, because, it was effective in some senses that people became Christians and were, turned to Christ in different parts of the world. But there was also a cultural spreading of Victorian British culture.
Yeah.
So it was imperialism as well. So you had the classic mission stations in the middle of Africa, that kind of outpost, if you like, not just of the gospel, but of Western British imperialism as well. Yeah. That's the reality when you look back into the history and, and you kind of, you can see that.
Just I think the missionary to China back in the day, I can't remember his name now, but it was the fact that he was very different as a missionary.
Yeah, he dressed as a native. Chinese and so on. Hudson Taylor.
Hudson Taylor, that's exactly right.
And obviously, Chinese inland mission, was it?
Yeah, that he started. But the point was that mode of actual, that you could differentiate between imperialism and the gospel was much more effective, actually, as opposed to just trying to push British values and British dress.
Yeah, but I think that when you see that the place the Bible had in Victorian Britain, so the Bible was revered, the Bible was part of the national conversation in Parliament, and people who spoke to the nation would refer to the Bible, even, you know, probably to World War II, Winston Churchill would often quote the Bible in his speeches and so on.
And the king calling people to pray.
Correct. And Winston Churchill would refer to God.
Yeah.
And there would be this assumption that God was on our side, good against evil, this sort of thing, that narrative. And then you know, you can pass the Second World War and that changed.
Mm.
That changed big time. And you get the 50s into the 60s, 70s, and so on. And to the days of Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell, when Alistair Campbell famously said, "We don't do God."
Mm.
Speaking about Tony Blair and the Labour Party at that stage. So they said explicitly, you know, we will not do God. He will not be part of our
national conversation
any longer. So that was quite significant, I think, and only reflected, I think, what was true of society. But my point is this: when you go back to the Victorian, you know, okay, the Bible was part, and there was a lot of good things, because, you know, biblical truth and principles, you know, it is truth.
Yeah.
You know, if you are able to put the Bible into practice, then it is righteousness that's being taught and declared and so on. Because the Bible is good.
Yeah.
So if people seek to live by the Bible, that is good. But that is not really, I would suggest, the gospel.
No.
The imposition of Judeo-Christian principles from the Bible upon a society that is not a society that has turned to God in reality. So it's a kind of artificial thing. So I think that you look back in those days and you forget that actually, you know, the UK was a very corrupt place. It was full of injustices and inequalities and all that kind of thing. And although the Bible was part and parcel of the national conversation, it didn't mean that Britain was a Christian country.
No. No. And having the Bible, though, as part of your national conversation, though, was healthier. Whereas I think that, as you've said, today it isn't part of our national conversation.
What do you mean it's healthier, though? What sense is it healthier?
I suppose the fact that people are having to grapple with some biblical issues, and they're having to grapple with the Bible's view of it. And like, fundamentally, you have to say, well, if God has said this, why, who are we to say that this isn't a good idea? So take the family. So God has talked about the centrality of the family, the importance of the family, the role of the family, the roles within the family. And then we say, well, it doesn't really matter. Well, how much has our society suffered in the UK because we don't value the family as we ought to? And you just think about, like, the significance of children that grow up without one or other of their parents, just the huge impact that has.
Yeah. To kind of argue against that, or to bring another aspect to it, one of the negatives when you look back is that you had a church which God was not much part of.
Yeah.
And you had people very disillusioned.
Yeah.
With the use of the Bible. So the Bible was used in many senses to kind of sustain a system of religion that actually was corrupt and ungodly and unbiblical.
Which is interesting, is when you say that, I wonder as well if that is not too dissimilar how it's been used even in America. The Bible is used to weaponize a political ideology and the maintenance of a particular
way of life. And it turns people off the truth of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So they're like, well, the Bible, you know, is associated with X, Y, and Z, therefore I don't want anything to do with that.
Yeah.
And if that's where the Bible is, then I have nothing to do with that. So, you know, the original question, I don't know, should the Bible be part of our national conversation? Well, you would hope so, but you would hope it would be part of a national conversation in the right way.
Yeah. I suppose there's a difference between imposing biblical, I suppose, is there? I just think about, if going back to the point about the family, we used to have a married person's tax allowance. That was a good way to encourage marriage from a financial perspective. Is that good? I think it is good. I think it's healthy to encourage that. The fact we don't have that, I think that's bad. I think even in terms of, this might sound quite archaic, but a sabbatical rest. So we have one day in the week where we rest. Well, how much are we paying as a society for the fact that we don't take rest?
So the question again would come, you know, this probably comes back to your prophetic views that you articulated as to, well, what is your role in society as a Christian?
Yeah.
Is it to change that society? Is it to improve that society? Is it to bring that society closer to what the Bible teaches? Is that your function? Is that your role? Is it the role of the church? Or is it not? And I think your prophetic view hugely impacts.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Because, for example, if you take your post-millennial, how you describe it? Then it very much is your role.
Yeah, because you have to Christianize the society. Correct. So the Lord can come back.
So, you know, this is your focal point.
Yeah.
If you take the role, the view, the middle view that you articulated, so the premillennial view, then you'd probably take the opposite view.
Well, you know, it's the society is going to get worse and worse. But I think that obviously the churches that we're associated with, because of our premillennial view, have sometimes inclined to not get involved in society and not recognize that, I do believe that we are salt and light.
But it depends on what level you're going to get involved in society in terms of biblical instruction in the New Testament. You know, lots of instruction about getting involved in society in a very local level.
Yeah.
You know, impacting your neighbor and, you know, living a Christian life that's going to impact those who are in your immediate vicinity, you know, your employer, your family, your neighborhood. So you can see instruction in the epistles for that. You have to live in a certain way so that people will be impacted, drawn to the Lord Jesus. You have to live out a God-honoring lifestyle and so on. But where would you point me to instruction in the New Testament to get involved at a higher level in society, to influence it in that way?
You would struggle.
Yeah.
Because I think that even when you've got something like the slave trade, that there's no thought in the New Testament that the slave trade, however inhumane it was, and obviously the slave owners that were good and kind in the New Testament, there's never a thought to overthrow that system, and that the apostles were keen.
Well, it was the opposite, wasn't it?
Because
the instruction was to submit
to
the existing authorities, not change them.
Yeah.
Even although these authorities in the days that the epistles were written were ungodly, violent and oppressive.
Yes.
I mean, they were by and large. And people were instructed as Christians to live out their Christian lives in submission to that authority because they understood that these authorities were ordained of God and that were part and parcel of God's purpose that they were in place at that time. So it's often been a point of discussion, the extent to which Christians should prioritize or focus their lives for the change of society. And then, of course, you have to balance that up by saying, well, you know, the teaching of biblical truth into that society will hopefully change it. So, for example, if you take the issue, the very emotive issue of the sanctity of life, either at birth or death,
mm-hmm.
which is a very big subject in our culture.
Yeah, and so presently relevant.
You've got discussions about abortion, you've got discussions about euthanasia, and mm-hmm. so on. And these are, you know, these are political discussions and discussions in society. So, you know, if these discussions are taking place, to what extent does the Christian seek to influence or have a voice into that conversation in the culture? So that, you know, that's not an easy, in my view, question to answer.
Yeah, and I think it's maybe helpful to recognize the fact that our prime responsibility is to pray, because we're commanded in Scripture to pray for kings,
yes,
and all those who are in authority. And also to recognize that's not a cop-out, because the proverb says God can turn the king's heart like water. So God doesn't need me to be involved in a political campaign to achieve his goals.
Yeah, because it's interesting that the purpose of that prayer is given.
Yeah, that we might lead a quiet and peaceful life.
Not that society would change.
In all godliness and honesty, though.
Yeah, but that we might live.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that context, Paul is saying, you know, pray for the authorities, pray for the, and so on. But he's, in my view, he's not speaking about the transformation of the society. He's speaking about the ability to live out your Christian life without being harassed and without being persecuted, basically.
Yeah.
And you need to pray for those in authority to that end. And the reason is that the gospel would.
Yeah. But then I suppose the thing is, we've had 2,000 years of church history where the impact of the gospel is it does transform a society.
Yeah, that's my point. You know, it's not an easy question.
No.
Because, you know, where do you draw that line?
Yeah.
You know, if you're seeking for simply the transformation of society, the gospel's probably seeking to transform people within the society.
Yeah.
And that different subtle difference, I think.
I suppose, yeah, it's transformation.
I'm not going to stand with a placard,
no.
Personally. Others do, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that personally, I'm not going to stand with a placard outside an abortion clinic, personally. But would I...
Just the very thought of that is...
Yeah, but would I teach and preach publicly about the sanctity of life? Yes, I would.
Yeah.
From the Bible.
Yeah.
So that's just my personal line.
Yeah.
In view. Now, we've strayed away from the place of the Bible in society, but not too much, because, you know, that's, you know, where do you...
You always see, I think this is the big question is how much should the Bible play and how should you as a Christian work that out in your life? And I suppose then, yeah, I suppose different people have different callings. Like if you're a Wilberforce, you're involved in politics.
Which is obviously a great thing historically because of what he accomplished.
And the significance of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of, I suppose that's one example down through history where kind of a biblical worldview has shaped the policies. And actually in our country, whether people recognize it or not, our language, our laws, so much of our culture is still based on that kind of mm-hmm. Judeo-Christian kind of, or it's a biblical worldview. And America as well. So we enjoy a lot of liberties here in the West because of that biblical foundation. And that, I suppose, is because people of a past generation focused on the gospel. And if you think back to even the Puritans, now, there may be their kind of, I think, faulty eschatological views didn't help, but their focus on the gospel definitely did, because they wanted to transform society from preaching faithfully in their church to change the community. And it was very much at a local level, laying aside Cromwell. But that kind of idea that you change people from within rather than imposing an external standard upon them that they have to then conform to. The gospel is about you change people from within.
And this goes back to your view in prophecy, because if your prophetic understanding is that society is going to wax worse and worse until the Lord comes, type of thing, then your expectation of your impact in that society is going to be shaped by your understanding of the prophetic program. So if you think that, you know, you are, you know, in the tribulation at the moment, and you have to fight and you have to battle and you have to overcome satanic forces and all this kind of stuff, that's going to shape the way that you conduct yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get involved in politics. Definitely. You should. If that's your worldview, your prophetic view. I mean, it's not mine. But if you think of the Christianification of society as your aim, then you need to get involved big time in that.
Yeah.
But if you don't think that, and if your aim is the salvation of individuals within a society that's getting worse and worse and worse, that's going to change your focus, I would suggest.
Yeah, and I think it's an issue of focus as opposed to an issue of activity. So if somebody wanted to support people who are going to an abortion clinic in some way, if that's your burden and ministry as part of your role in the local church, crack on. You do that. But the church, and collectively, I think our focus should always be in terms of the gospel. But do people have a role outside of that? Yeah. And you might be a great lawyer and you might want to go and do some work for Christian Concern or something and lobby the government to change the laws to make them fairer or more equitable or whatever it might be. I don't think that's a wrong thing to do. And I don't think...
No.
We should encourage people not to, because we have this view that it's only going to get worse and worse. And therefore, we're citizens of heaven. We're not citizens on earth. Well, we're citizens of both. We have dual nationality. Our prime nationality and identity is our heavenly citizenship. But we don't stop becoming a citizen of the UK. Paul didn't pretend that he wasn't a Roman citizen. Oftentimes, he used that Roman citizenship for the furtherance of the gospel. So I don't think we ought to neglect, but what issues present themselves to you in that? Yeah, that might be quite different to different people who have got different skill set. But I think it's important that we don't encourage people not to, or we say it's wrong to. But yeah, we keep the first things first. Our focus has to be the gospel.
Yeah, that would be my view. And, you know, if you are impacting your environment positively, that's a good thing. I mean, if unrighteousness is lessened by your activities, great. You know, if you can bring about, you know, justice, great. You know, but is that your focal point? And is this what your life is going to be about? Well, in my view, that there's a higher calling.
Yeah.
For the Christian today.
Yeah.
Which is the gospel.
Yeah.
The transformative gospel.
And I think that there's another aspect of this which I think is relevant in terms of academia. I think, again, in circles that we're familiar with, academia was not a place that the Christian pursued so much. I think if you were in a few exceptional cases, it was okay. But we have to recognize that it's often in those academic circles where government policy starts to germinate before it comes to fruition. It's in those kind of, in the academic circles that a lot of even what comes out into popular culture starts. So if you've got a Christian voice in that, that's a good thing and a healthy thing. Of course, not everybody is kind of called to be an academic, but we shouldn't say that it's not a place for the Christian. I think that's the key distinction. And I think that a past generation did make that mistake. They legislated against, you don't get into politics, you don't get into academia, you don't do this. Well, if that's your MO, then don't be surprised if those areas are then overtaken by people who think very differently. And inevitably that will start impacting your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I still think you can do that and hold that kind of, you can still engage in that and still hold the gospel as the prime thing that your gospel is about, whether we are involved in academia, selfish, or are a lawyer or whatever. So, but in terms of the Bible and public life, but you would say, though, it's right for us as Christians to teach the Bible in a public setting.
And what do you mean?
Well, you said, I think earlier on about teaching about, say, euthanasia. Is it right to kind of explain about the biblical view of?
100%.
Purely in a kind of local church context?
Not necessarily, no. So to me, there's a difference in, there'd be a difference in emphasis if what you're doing is how you go about the thing. I mean, are you lobbying? Are you protesting? Or are you presenting? So, you know, you can stand, you can get a crowd of people up and you can have a protest and march through the streets with banners and all the rest of it. That to me is not something I would do personally. But if I had an opportunity to explain and teach what the Bible says about anything,
mm-hmm.
then I would do.
Yeah.
And whatever that opportunity might be, whatever it may be. But I would see a difference between shouting in the street,
mm-hmm.
the kind of slogan, and I'm maybe being a bit harsh, but seeking to influence decision makers in that way, rather than presenting the teaching of the Bible, yeah. wouldn't be something I would.
I'm not inclined to go to a protest, but I still think that there's probably, it's important that as a culture, as a society, we have that right.
But even if you think about the word protest.
Yeah.
You know, where's your biblical mandate for protesting against authority?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree that the Christian shouldn't focus on that. But I'm asking, as a citizen of this country, do I think we should have the right to protest? I think we should. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think whether people have placards or not, it's interesting even just this whole idea of the cancel culture of, like, even now that every political cause, you've got to change your Facebook profile color to represent this. And if you don't, then you're somehow siding with kind of people who are misogynist or people who are racist or that. And this kind of lack of debate, I think having free and open discourse is essential. And I think having the right to protest is an important feature of our culture and society. But am I likely to do it? No. But I still think it's important that we have it. And obviously you would prefer to spend your time engaging with people at a more kind of thoughtful level and engaging in the arguments. But would you debate in public?
Would I debate in public? Yeah, I would debate in public.
Would you organize a debate in public?
I would not.
Okay.
Organize a debate. I would have no reason for not doing that.
It's a wonderfully Stephen Grant answer. I would not do it.
You know, it depends in the context of it and the purpose of it.
Yeah.
You know, why are you doing it? You know, and so on. And what are you debating? What's your outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're trying to change government policy about something, or if you're debating the Bible.
Yeah, the upholding and the proclamation of the truth, I think, is,
yeah.
That's, I think that is a biblically mandated.
Yeah, but not with the assumption that people who are not Christians or people who are not of God can be expected to have the same view of the Bible as those who are?
No.
And so your expectations are different.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you got an opportunity to say, to speak what is right, then that's fine.
Yeah. You know? We don't judge the success of a gospel meeting on the basis that the people who are unbelievers that come into it convert. We believe that there's an importance in presenting the truth. And if the debate does that, whether you actually win the debate or not, I don't think that's important, because when you're presenting the truth of Scripture, you're sowing seed, and that seed may not germinate then or ever, but it's important that we sow the seed. We're commanded to sow the seed.
Yeah, and if it's God-honoring, if it kind of if it informs people of the character of God and of the righteousness of God, yeah, and so on, I'm just not political.
No.
So at any level.
Is that true?
Yes.
You're not political at any level. You don't have any political views.
I don't have any political involvement.
Okay. But you're politically aware.
Politically aware, but not active.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm aware of what's going on.
Do you do that because you believe that that is, you're just interested in it, or do you think there's an element of responsibility?
I'm interested in it in respect that, you know, it's on the news and so on. I am not enamored by the political system or those who are part of it, no matter which side or colour.
Yeah.
There's no one out there who is speaking for me. So there's no one out there who I would support personally, because mm-hmm. there's significant things that I believe and practice that I don't know any politician who would represent that.
So what if the government asked for your opinion on a political issue? Would you give it?
If they asked for my opinion, in what way?
Like an opinion?
Like a referendum?
Well,
there have been referendums and I haven't voted in them.
Okay.
I've exercised my right not to do so.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'm part of the political process, because part of the political process in this country is the right not to,
yeah,
as well as the right to. And both are valid positions to take within our system.
Which is different. Is it Canada? You have
Australia, I think Australia, it is, that you have to.
Yeah.
So I may have a different view there, but here you're quite entitled
not to. But equally though, is it a matter of conscience? It's not a matter of...
It's not conscience in the sense, I don't think it's conscience.
I was meaning in terms of, it's not biblically mandated that you're not to be involved in that process. As in, do you think that if I was to vote in a referendum, I would be sinning?
No.
Yeah. So...
That would matter for you.
So it's a matter of conscience then?
Yeah, if you want to express it that way, but it's probably more a matter of your understanding of the role of a Christian within society.
Yeah.
And so you act accordingly.
Yeah. And so I did take part in a referendum.
So would you vote in a general election?
If I had somebody to vote for, yeah.
So would you ever anticipate that would be the case?
No.
Okay.
I don't anticipate that.
So would you not see that part of your civic duty is to vote, even though someone doesn't fully represent?
No, not necessarily. Like, I remember we were in Shetland at the time, and Alistair Carmichael came to visit, and he says, look, I think you need to vote Lib Dem, because if you don't, the SNP will get in. And that's a valid point, because in Shetland at that point, it was neck and neck, SNP, Lib Dem. And it's like, you may not agree with the Lib Dems, but if you don't vote for us, then the SNP are going to get in. They're even worse. And that was his argument. It's not an entirely bad argument, but I chose not to.
It's not a very strong argument.
He's just wanting a vote. He didn't get a vote. But the point was, it's another aspect of voting. Obviously, we don't have a two-tier system like they do in America, but if people want to ask me for my opinion on a political issue, then I will give it to them. whether that's through asking me on the door or whether that's asking me to go into a booth and put a cross in a box, that's fine. But yeah, voting for a party, yeah, if there was a party to vote for, then that I think would be good for the country in a variety of ways. Yeah, I don't have any problem with the concept of voting for them. I don't think voting is you're voting against the will of God. I think that's a misunderstanding of the distinction between God's permissive will and God's intended will.
I don't vote on a kind of principle basis that I don't see that as being part of my role within society.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to be consistent to that. So that if I voted in a general election, I would feel I should vote in every election.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I feel I should, then I should be consistent in that.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than pick and choose. You know, if you feel it's your duty as a citizen to engage and to in that process in that way, then do that. But do it consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't feel it, then don't do it at all.
Yeah.
So I don't do it at all. But, you know, I have no problem with someone who does. None at all.
Yeah. And, yeah, I don't think you can legislate from scripture that you can't.
No, I would agree.
Yeah.
And I would never try to.
Yeah. But I also think that when we think about the role of the church and the involvement with politics, it is essential that politics is not taken into the church, that we're not there to, as some Christian preachers do in America, they will say, now remember to put your vote in for so-and-so.
So how can you keep what you do at the church when you're part, you are the church?
Say, what do you mean?
How can you keep politics out of the church when you are the church?
Yeah, well, in terms of, I don't think that we're there to campaign for a political party or to make the church isn't there to dictate to people what they should do politically. I think the church is there primarily for the glory of God, for the edification of the believers, and we allow their convictions to work out in what they do politically. But we're not there to push a political agenda. I think that would be an important distinction that I would make. Why do you disagree?
No, I just think it's interesting that you draw a distinction between what the church locally, because there is no national church.
Yeah.
So what your local church does and what you do.
You say there's a distinction in what I
make. Yeah.
What is that distinction?
Well, you just articulated it. You said that the church is not there for, but I will do that.
Yeah. Because I appreciate that even in the local church, you are the sum of your members. Like, it's based on what individuals do. But I'm drawing a distinction between what the church publicly, through its teaching, through the leadership of its elders, what its expectations are of the people and what it's telling people and teaching people what to do from a political perspective. That's the distinction I'm making, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you keep politics out of the church, but you don't keep church out of politics.
Oh, because I want to have because I express an opinion in a referendum.
Or vote in a general election.
Yeah, because I think that that's part of, we are citizens of this country, so therefore we have civic responsibility, however that.
So it's a civic responsibility?
Yeah.
So then you must vote?
I don't think you have to vote, but you have civic responsibilities, like we're to be citizens of the country, we're to be good citizens.
Yeah, so is voting part of your civic responsibility?
Not necessarily, no. But then I've never said that you have to vote. Yeah. I'm just saying that you shouldn't legislate
I'm only
against
poking
it.
You.
That's fine. Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. I suppose that obviously what this whole episode is about talking about the role that the Bible plays in public life. And we would both believe that we think the Bible should play a more prominent role in public life. That would not be a bad thing. It would be a good thing. But I suppose the other aspect of church history is that the more that happens, the more that it very quickly morphs into something
yeah.
that is very destructive and dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there needs to, and destructive also to the gospel.
Absolutely.
Because it then gets identified with something that is man-made, and very often the opposite, really, of what the Bible actually teaches.
Yeah.
So there needs to be that balance, in my view, and also the balance of your expectation as a Christian.
Yeah.
That you're not going to superimpose the Bible into people's lives and expect them to be able to carry it out. When you understand this, that so much of the Bible is being taught to people who are indwelt by the Spirit of God, Christians,
yeah.
And it's instruction for that environment, you know, the church and so on, and to then superimpose that in society, it's an unrealistic expectation that society can actually live up to it.
See, I'm conscious of time, but I really want to push back slightly because on that, like, but you wouldn't think it's good if this assisted suicide bill that's currently being debated, if that goes through. You would want a biblical view of life and the sanctity of life to be imposed upon people who personally, their illness is such that they actually want to end their life. We would believe as Christians that it's actually not good for them to do that.
Yeah, I think I'm drawing a distinction between, as I mentioned, the teacher of the Bible that is taught to Christians in a church context, and they have a capacity to fulfill it because they're indwelt by the Spirit of God, and the fruit of the Spirit is going to be produced in their lives. Therefore, they're going to be able to live in a certain way, or should be able to live in a certain way that's Christ-like. If you expect someone who is not indwelt by the Spirit of God to be able to do the same, it's an unrealistic expectation. So that you can, I mean, there are standards of righteousness and all the rest of it, societal standards, if you like, to do with birth, death, family, and things like this.
So what kind of imposition are you talking about? What do you think is unrealistic?
So it's probably unrealistic to expect relationships to function as they're taught. Because what? You're taught in the New Testament that
male and female head, like female head or male headship.
Probably. And the working out of that. But even on a more base level, it's not that it wouldn't be good if people were able to live like that, because it's right to do so. But the whole flaw within society is that if you're operating without God in your life, then your capacity to actually reach these levels, or you can't. It's the whole principle of sin, it's the whole principle of being a sinner, is that you cannot meet those standards or live in that way. And that's where the gospel comes in, to free you from sin and to provide you with the capacity also to please God and live in a way that otherwise is impossible to do so. The law is to prove the sinfulness of sin, you know, and the law is good. You know, and if you could live according to the law of God, that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But what does the law do? It doesn't help you live that way. It demonstrates that you cannot live that way.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously that's true. But okay, we have this, just to use the illustration then of male headship. So if this biblical view of marriage that you're saying is a standard that's too high for society to be able to attain to.
Well, we look around.
Yeah, but the point is that the society are always going to deviate from the perfect model, whether that's through male domination, whether it's through a whole variety of aberrations and deformities from the true. But does that mean that you shouldn't uphold that?
What do you mean by uphold it?
Do what you can to encourage it.
Well, that's a different thing than impose. And your expectation is what I'm talking about.
Okay, so but a law against chauvinism.
Yeah, my point would be, I mean, laws like that are obviously good because any law against something which is evil is good.
Yeah.
But your understanding would be, as a Christian, that the imposition of law does not change the person.
No.
In principle, we know that to be the case in the Bible.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of the law, that the law could not change the individual.
No.
So all you're looking at then basically is behavior modification to the best of someone's ability without giving them, with the expectation and understanding that within them, they do not have the capacity to meet that standard.
Yeah. So Robert Murray McShane hymn, "The law bids me
correct
fly, but neither gives me wings."
So is the law bad? No. Would a law that says chauvinism is illegal or whatever, you know, an extreme expression of that, good? Yeah. What's your expectation though of society?
Yeah.
You're going to get disappointed.
Well,
you can't otherwise.
Yeah, the law is made for the lawless, according to 1 Timothy.
But is it, my point is, we understand the purpose of the law in the Old Testament. When you come to the New Testament, so much of the New Testament is not written in that context. It's written for churches, mm-hmm. not for society. So the letters are for churches.
Yeah.
The audience are Christians. And to transpose that upon an ungodly society is to take from one context, put it onto another context, which is not to say that there's not a lot of stuff in there that would be good for society if it was lived out in society. Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
But actually to be lived out, not in society, but in church.
Yeah.
Because the key difference is the Spirit of God.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose your thing is that you only get disappointed if you try that.
That's my point. What's your expectation?
Yeah.
What's your intention? You know, if you take the New Testament and you're like, we can live this out as a church, we should, going to teach it as, there's mandates in there for us. Am I going to say to, you know, my neighbors, you should be living like this, you know, and boom, 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 boom. And they say, yeah, but we can't, or we don't want to. So what do you do then?
Yeah, I suppose there's a distinction though between
penalise them?
To saying to your neighbour, like you as a Christian saying to your neighbour, you shouldn't be putting your washing out on a Sunday or whatever kind of law that you want to impose. But is it good for those who are part of our legislative powers to adopt a biblical worldview?
Well, what I'm saying is that any law that people pass that is we understand that.
Yeah, we're going to get disappointed.
No, but we understand that God's purpose in government is for the punishment of evildoers and for basically the exaltation of righteousness and the rewarding of those that do good. So anything that does that is actually biblical.
Yeah. Well, and it's a good thing. And although people are going to break those laws and we as Christians may be discouraged and it doesn't matter.
So government is good when it's functioning in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. My point is the extent of your expectation should be moderated and also—
Yeah, that's true. I think that's fair.
I would say it's up to the individual, the extent to which they get involved in that government process.
Yeah.
That's a matter for them.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be the focus of the church.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're making a distinction there between the individual and the church collectively.
Well, no, the same thing.
Okay. But you're saying
my focus.
Okay.
Because, you know, I don't like when I distinguish between the church locally and the individual so much. Because I think it's a cop-out because, you know, you disassociate as if this corporate body is not me, is actually me.
Yeah. Okay. No, I see that that's true, but I suppose there's a difference between what you as a church are saying, this is good to be involved in, and this is what we as a church are going to do. You don't, and then what I as an individual am doing with my time.
Yeah, you see, I don't like disassociating the two.
No, but we do it in lots of ways already. Like you don't control everybody in your church in what they do.
What I do is representative of the church.
Yeah, but it's not controlled by the church. And there's a distinction.
To some extent.
Yeah, outside of biblical authority. But you don't have the right as an elder to go into a family home and say, what you're doing as a husband here is unbiblical, it's sinful, and it's not right. But you don't have the right to say, you can't have that job.
I don't know. No, I get your point.
Yeah. or you need to live in a different house, you can't have that car.
No, because that's not. Yeah, I get your point.
Yeah. So anyway.
Anyway, we've strayed all over the place there, but.
Yeah. But hopefully, whether most people are still tuned in now or they've switched off, remains to be seen. But anyway, Bible and public life, it's an interesting topic.
It is an interesting topic.
And we hope that you'll join us next time for our final episode in this little series, where we're going to talk about how does the church respond to the cultural moment that exists, where people are inquiring. So until then, thank you very much.
Thank you.